numbers 1 through 10. Brother Roger.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and good morning, my dear sisters. Welcome to another morning, to another day, around the life and the story of Hannah. So, in our first study this morning, as we've had read, we come to the first 10 verses, and you might remember that in our last study yesterday, we left Hannah at that moment when Samuel was weaned, and she had brought him to the tabernacle of the congregation, you remember, to leave him there in the care, not so much of Eli, but of Yahweh himself. She loaned the child unto the Lord. And we closed with this question, you might remember, how could she be so joyful on such a day? And for that matter, how do we know she was joyful on the day that she loaned her son? And of course, the answer lies in the song that now turns up in the second chapter in these first 10 verses, which has come to be known as Hannah's Song. And part of the spirit of that hymn that we've just sung, and by the way, if you didn't know, it's an excellent hymn, very good to add to an ecclesial repertoire, and I think it captures some of the spirit of Hannah's song, some of the spirit of Hannah's praise, you see. And it's one of the most remarkable of all prayers, this song of Hannah in these first few verses. It's uttered from the lips of such an inspirational woman that we're privileged to now look at what she said and think about what she spoke. And perhaps the highest accolade that could be given to the song of Hannah was that when Mary, the mother of Messiah, was looking to be inspired herself, she fashioned her prayer of thanksgiving by quoting Hannah's song. In a sense, there could be no higher accolade, could there, as far as this song is concerned. It's an interesting thing, you know, that some have observed that Hannah offered her thanksgiving after her child was born, whereas Mary offered her prayer before Christ was born. As if perhaps in some way that suggests that perhaps Mary's prayer was greater because she offered her prayer before the child had even come. Actually, I don't think that's really the circumstance at all. I think the reality is a little different because when you think about it, Mary offered an outpouring of praise at the prospect of receiving a child. But Hannah sang her song of praise at the moment of giving a child away. How much greater, in a sense, is Hannah's song, don't you think? She sang at the time of giving a child away, and yet although she's just given that child, there's not a trace, not a hint of lamentation, or even of pain at her loss. And the reason is, you see, that Hannah's prayer is so spiritual, so focused on God, so devoid of personal vindication, so steeped in biblical thinking, that it's taken up as a model of expression in many other parts of Scripture. Many other scriptural places will draw on this hymn by this sister for inspiration themselves in other parts of the scriptural record. And so verse 1 says, "And Hannah prayed and said, My heart rejoiceth in the Lord." Now, when you think about it, even that opening spirit is important, isn't it? Because what it's saying is that Hannah didn't see this as some personal contest for recognition or for vindication or for validation. It doesn't come across that way, does it? That's not her spirit at all. Even in this opening line, do you notice, there's not a trace of self in her prayer. Her thoughts are far above her own situation. They're thoroughly centered on God. My heart, she says, rejoices in the Lord, which is really where the emphasis of that first line is. My heart rejoices in Yahweh, That's where her thinking was. My horn is exalted in Yahweh. Now, the horn is a symbol of the focus of a person's power or might. And it seems that Hannah was the first person to use this particular expression. I suppose in that day, where there were lots of domestic animals, that the horns of the animals that were noted around even the houses and the homes of the people in those days, that it was perhaps understandable that the horn become used as a symbol of a person's power or a person's focus or a person's might. And it's going to be taken up in many other places, of which this is one, which we won't turn up, but I'll just read to you. It's Psalm 112 and verse 9, when it says this. It says, "He hath dispersed, he hath given to the poor, his righteousness endureth forever, his horn shall be exalted with honour," says Psalm 112, verse 9. And in the margin it says, see the first of Samuel, chapter 2, verse 1. And I think that Psalm 112 is quoting from Hannah's prayer, you see, that she's the first one to use that expression. My horn is exalted. But notice that it's exalted in the Lord. It's not so much that she's worried about her own exaltation, but that in God's exaltation, Hannah herself found her own purpose and meaning. And in fact, she goes on to say in that verse, my mouth is enlarged over mine enemies. Oh, now that's interesting. Enemies. Plural. Did you notice that? Plural. So this is not Penina. My mouth is enlarged over mine enemies. So who were Hannah's enemies? And the song will reply, by the time we come to the end of what Hannah says, that her enemies were God's enemies. And we'll discover in the course of this song who she considered God's enemies to be. But it wasn't Penina that she had in mind at all. I don't think she ever was thinking of Penina. And so when it says that her mouth was enlarged, her mouth was enlarged to express Yahweh's disapproval of those who were Yahweh's enemies as well as herself. Now, notice how this first verse unfolds then. Her heart rejoices in God. Her horn is exalted in God. Her mouth is enlarged to speak the truth of God. You see, she's absolutely God-centered. Her rejoicing was in Yahweh and his salvation, and she saw all of this as being made possible in the giving of this child now that's been brought into her life. And so she says, verse 2, "There is none holy as Yahweh. There is none beside thee, neither is there any rock like our God." Now, in the Hebrew of verse 2, the three lines of this verse all begin with the same Hebrew word. It's the Hebrew word en, which literally means, "There is no." There is no. So the real Hebrew says, "There is no, there is no one holy as Yahweh. There is no, there is none beside thee. There is no rock like our God." And so all three of these lines again are expressive of the absolute supremacy and importance of God. That's how Hannah feels. That's how Hannah thinks. "There's none to be compared with God," she says, "in any way, shape, or form. No other God beside thee." And now in that context, she says, "None as holy as the Lord." That's an allusion to Exodus 15, verse 11. "None beside thee," that's an allusion to Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 35. "No rock like our God," that's an allusion to Deuteronomy 32, verses 4 and 5. And we suddenly realize that Hannah knows her Bible. Hannah quotes her Bible. Hannah speaks her Bible. Hannah's prayer is based on biblical principles and biblical language, which is a thing we mentioned yesterday, do you remember, in our consideration of prayer. Hannah uses scriptural words when she prays. Now think about this. How much of scripture do you think Hannah had available to her? We're only in the book of Judges. I think she had the first five books of Moses, and probably not a lot else besides. I'm almost certain she had the book of Job. And many of you will know that the book of Job was written very early in the piece in terms of the chronology of the writing of Scripture. Job's a very early book, one of the most ancient books. She certainly has the book of Job. She's going to quote it. And she certainly quotes from the books of Genesis and Exodus, and she quotes from the Torah. So she knows her Bible. This is the thing. So her prayer is expressed in the language and thought of Scripture itself. Now, already that's a remarkable thing. But it's even more remarkable when you think about it, because you see, Hannah wouldn't have had a Bible. People didn't have Bibles. The only Bibles were in the scrolls that the priests had at the tabernacle of the congregation. So how did Hannah know to quote Exodus 15 and Deuteronomy chapter 4 and Deuteronomy chapter 32? How did she do that? Well, because she'd been to the sanctuary at the time that the priest read the book of the law. She'd committed it to memory. This woman loved the truth so passionately and so well that when she'd been to the times when the priest had opened the book of the law and read, she was there, she heard, she listened, she memorized that. And she took that home and she turned those words over in her heart and in her mind. She knew those scriptures. She didn't have a Bible of her own at home to use. And yet when she bursts into this prayer of thanksgiving and praise to God, what comes cascading out are the words of Scripture, because that's how this woman thought. You see, I think this is the thing, that when we learn to think in scriptural ways, and we think of scriptural expressions, it changes how we pray to God. Perhaps it even changes how we think about life. If you think about life through the lens of scriptural language, changes how you think about life, how you talk about life. This woman was an astounding example of having captured scriptures in her own heart. And now she says, verse 3, "Talk no more so exceeding proudly, let not arrogancy come out of your mouth." And in view of the all-surpassing greatness and supremacy of God that she's just mentioned in verse 2, yes, it was totally wrong for anyone to speak with either pride or arrogance. Now, what's interesting about verse 3 is I think this is the first of two occasions where Hannah's comments are going to focus on the adversaries of God. And when she says in verse 1, "My mouth is enlarged over mine enemies," she's going to explain that her enemies are God's enemies. And there's going to be two places in the song where she will talk about who those enemies are. Here's the first of those two occasions. Now you see, it's usually assumed, isn't it, that this is perhaps a reference to Penina, "Talk no more so exceeding proudly." But I don't think the context supports that. In the complete story of Hannah's recorded life, in all that we know about Hannah, there's only one person, only one instance of a person who spoke with arrogance and pride, and it wasn't Penina. It was somebody else. And it's someone that's already come into the record to our attention, because Hophni and Phinehas are going to be noted for exactly that spirit. Do you remember the man of the clenched fist and the man of the brazen mouth? Those who are aggressive in their deeds and arrogant in their words. And when she says, "Talk ye no more so exceeding proudly, let not arrogancy come out of your mouth," I believe that she has in mind Hophni and Phinehas, the corrupt priests who'd been so damaging to the spiritual state of the nation. And that was a reference in particular here to Phinehas, the man of the brazen mouth, as his name means. And that was especially significant in view of the role of the priests. Because what did Malachi chapter 2 say about the priests? "For the priest's lips should keep knowledge. They should seek the law of God at his mouth. But this priest, at this time, in this sanctuary, he spoke with arrogance and pride." And I believe that it's those priests that Hannah has in mind that are Yahweh's enemies. And so she says, verse 3, "Do not speak like that, because Yahweh is a God of knowledge. By him actions are weighed." You know, there's tremendous comfort in this, isn't there? That sometimes we might think that God doesn't know, but God does. God always knows. He does see. He does understand what's happening in our lives. Even in those times when we feel that we might be alone, the Father knows exactly what's going on. He's a God of knowledge. And, says the record, by him actions are weighed. Now, just come for a moment to the book of Proverbs, and let me give you a couple of cross-references that I think, all cross-references are helpful, but it's helpful in just commenting on this particular spirit of Hannah's words. In Proverbs 16, verse 2, here's a couple of passages in Proverbs that are very similar to what Hannah is in fact saying here. By him, actions are weighed. So you see Proverbs 16, verse 2. All the ways of a man are clean in his own eyes, but Yahweh weigheth the spirits. See, that's the point. No matter what we think about ourselves, it is God who weighs the spirits, you see. And again in chapter 21 of Proverbs, in Proverbs 21 and also verse 2, it says, every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but Yahweh pondereth the hearts. And that's so similar to what Hannah says here, is that by him actions are weighed. And so what we learn from what Hannah says here is it doesn't really matter what we think about ourselves, and incidentally it certainly doesn't matter what other people think about us. What does matter is what God thinks about us. You see, Hannah was not self-centered in any way. Even under the provocation of trial, she was able to rest in the knowledge that God weighs the spirits and God ponders the hearts. And so she reminds herself of that as she offers this song of thankfulness and praise. And then she says in verse 4 these words, the bows of the mighty men are broken. Did you read that carefully? The bows of the mighty men. Whatever sharp words Peninnah might have uttered, she cannot be the bow, the bows, plural, of mighty men, masculine, plural. She's not thinking of Peninnah, is she? Who were these Gibborim, as the word is in the Hebrew? Well, in the immediate context of Hannah's times, Gideon is called a mighty man in Judges 6, verse 12. Jephthah is called a mighty man in Judges 11, verse 1. Boaz is called a mighty man in Ruth chapter 2, verse 1. These are all nearby to the time of Hannah. And the word indicates those who are prominent in their status and prominent in their influence. This is not a reference to the Philistines. It's to the men of the day who exerted control, who held power, and who made decisions. And who was that? Who were the mighty men of the moment? Who were the mighty men of the day? And the answer is, why, Hophni and Phinehas, the sons of Eli, who exercised the priestly office and governed everything that happened at the sanctuary of God, and pretty much through the nation at that time. These were the mighty men that she has in mind. And in the context of verse 3, incidentally, the bow here is not a symbol of military force, but of boastful speech. Now, come to the book of Psalms, and let's just have a look at that. In Psalm 11, notice that the bow can be used, and is used, frequently in Scripture concerning not so much military adventure as the way in which we can use words upon and against one another. So Psalm 11 and verse 2 says, for lo, the wicked bend their bow, they make ready their arrow upon the string, that they may privily shoot at the upright in heart. These bows shot arrows against other people of words. Or again, in Psalm 37 and verse 14, we read these words. Psalm 37 verse 14 says, the wicked have drawn out the sword and have bent their bow. to cast down the poor and the needy, to slay such as be of upright conversation. Their sword shall enter into their own heart, and their bows shall be broken. And the margin says, see the 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 4. A little that a righteous man hath is better than the riches of many wicked, for the arms of the wicked shall be broken, but Yahweh upholdeth the righteous. These bows are to draw arrows of hatred and bitterness and strife against others. And one last passage while we're in the book of Psalms, in Psalm 64 and verses 2 to 4, it says this. Psalm 64, verses 2 to 4, hide me from the secret counsel of the wicked, from the insurrection of the workers of iniquity, who whet their tongue like a sword, and bend their bows to shoot their arrows, even bitter words, that they may shoot in secret at the perfect. Suddenly do they shoot at him and fear not. You see, these were the bows of the mighty men that I think that Hannah had in mind. This is not so much battles against the Philistines. This was the work of Hophni and Phinehas, and the words of arrogancy and pride that they used to exert control in a boastful way upon all those with whom they had influence. And so what she says, what Hannah says in the 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 4, she says, she sees the coming day, the bows of the mighty men are broken. And they that stumble are girded with strength. And Hannah knew what it felt like to feel as if she was stumbling in the way. Hannah knew what it felt like to feel as if she was lost. But suddenly the roles are reversed. Suddenly everything's about to change. And in the birth of her son, she saw the possibilities that would emerge, that if this child was indeed Yahweh's, and he had been given to her for the purpose that she had in mind, that God might in him raise up a faithful priest, then the destiny of Hophni and Phinehas was sealed. She saw their overthrow. She saw it all happening as a result of those possibilities. In fact, see what verse 5 says? They that were full have hired themselves out for bread. Now, the overall sense of these verses that follow, verse 5, verse 6, verse 7, verse 8, there is sort of like a theme to these verses, and the overall sense is that God has the power to reverse life's circumstances. It's one of the most important lessons that we all are asked to learn in the journey of life. That God can change everything overnight. But true though this observation was, I think there was something very specific in Hannah's words here concerning the destiny of Yahweh's enemies. Because she knew that Eli's family was corrupt. She knew that Hophni and Phinehas needed to be replaced. And I think that she prayed here in these very words for the removal of that priesthood. So that when she says, they that were full have hired themselves out for bread, she envisaged a time when the priesthood of the house of Eli would be overthrown. Now, there's a reason why I say that. And the remarkable thing here is that so in step was Hannah with the divine purpose that God will send a man to pronounce judgment upon the priests, and that man will pronounce judgment using the very words of Hannah here out of her prayer. Now come and have a look at this just over the page, because do you remember how in verse 27 of this same chapter, we're going to be told later on in a section which, by the way, we won't have time to look at in this weekend, but in verse 27, there came a man of God unto Eli, and he's going to pronounce judgment against the house of Eli. And so he says, verse 31, the day is come that I will cut off thine arm and the arm of thy father's house, that there shall not be an old man in thy house. So there was going to be judgment uttered and executed against the house of Eli. Now, notice what it says in the terms of judgment that the man of God brings against Eli and his sons. Verse 36. And it shall come to pass that everyone that is left in thine house shall come and crouch to him for a piece of silver and a morsel of bread, and shall say, put me, I pray thee, into at least one of the priest's offices, that I may eat a piece of bread. This is the prophecy of the overthrow of the house of Eli. That they will desperately seek for a piece of bread, that they might be given some menial task in whatever new priestly order was intended to replace them. And Hannah says, they that were full have hired themselves out for bread, verse 5. That's exactly the grounds of judgment by which the overthrow of the house of Eli are going to be described later on in this very chapter. It's as if God quotes Hannah's prayer. Isn't that remarkable? So I think it's all about the priesthood. That's exactly what she has in mind. And do you know that when Mary quotes Hannah in her prayer, do you know what she says in Luke chapter 1, verse 53, which we won't turn up because we're going to enjoy a little bit of time with Mary tomorrow. But when Mary quotes Hannah's prayer, she says this, "He hath filled the hungry with good things, and the rich he hath sent empty away." And in Luke's gospel, the term rich is used as a symbol of the priesthood. Because the rich people in the Lord's day were the Sadducees, the priests. They controlled the wealth. And Mary, quoting Hannah, says, "He's filled the hungry with good things, but the rich, the priests, he sent empty away." And so Mary, I think, understood what Hannah meant in her song about they that were full have hired themselves out for bread. Hannah meant the priests. And I think Mary understood that when she quotes Hannah in the New Testament record. And so finally verse 5 says, "And the barren woman hath borne 7, and she that hath many children is waxed feeble." You see, when she says the barren woman hath borne 7, I think, by the way, it's a Hebrew expression. If you just come back a couple of pages to Ruth chapter 4, Ruth 4 verse 15 says, "And he shall be unto thee a restorer of thy life and a nourisher of thine old age, for thy daughter-in-law which loveth thee is better to thee than 7 sons. She hath borne him." So better than 7 sons is a Hebrew expression that indicates absolute completeness and fullness, doesn't it? So the barren woman has born 7. She's given the complete blessings of a family. And that was going to be true, we will find, even in the story of Hannah's own life and circumstances. And then she says in verse 6, "The Lord killeth, Yahweh killeth and maketh alive. He bringeth down to the grave and bringeth up." And you see, this was Hannah's own personal experiences. As one who'd been made barren, one who'd been brought low, she knew the power of, literally, in verse 6, of bringing life out of death. But her words, incidentally, are a quotation from Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verse 39. So, you see, Hannah's words are an expansion, I think, one of the clearest statements in the Old Testament about belief in the power of the resurrection. Yahweh killeth and maketh alive, he bringeth down to the grave and bringeth up. She's one of the few people in the Old Testament who understands the doctrine of the resurrection. God can do all these things, she says. And so she says in verse 7, "Yahweh maketh poor and maketh rich. He bringeth low and lifteth up." But notice again that the emphasis of verse 7 is the fact that it is what God can do and does do in our lives. See, this is about the truth of the power of providence in our daily experience. Yahweh can make poor. Yahweh can make rich. Yahweh can bring low. Yahweh is able to lift up. And we've got to learn to recognize the hand of God in both the good and the evil in our lives. In fact, if you come back to Ecclesiastes, we made mention of this yesterday, but let's just go and have a look at this proverb, Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Because there is a lesson here that I think Hannah has rightly drawn attention to in terms of that providential working of God in all the circumstances of our lives. And that's this, that somehow, because of how human nature works, we imagine that God can only be working in our lives in the good things. And that's actually not true. So Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 14 says, "In the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider, God hath set the one over against the other, to the end that man should find nothing after him." So the lesson of Ecclesiastes is that God actually brings both the day of prosperity and the day of adversity into our lives. God does them both. God makes rich and God makes poor. And there are times in our lives that we all go through this journey where things haven't always worked out right. Well, that's the hand of God in our lives, as much as the good times, says Ecclesiastes. In fact, have a look at this. In fact, remember I said that I think she had the book of Job? I think Hannah's got a copy of the book of Job. Have a look at this, Job chapter 1. See, this is out of Job, isn't it, really? Her thinking is out of the book of Job when she says this. Remember in Job chapter 1, it's part of the greatness of Job, actually. Job 1 verse 21, that first catastrophic chapter of absolute disaster after disaster upon his family. And verse 20 says of Job chapter 1, Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell upon the ground and worshipped and said, naked came I out of my mother's womb and naked shall I return thither. Yahweh gave and Yahweh hath taken away. Blessed be the name of Yahweh. What a remarkable demonstration of faith. That even in a day of adversity, he says, this is all of God. Blessed be the name of God. And again, over the page in chapter 2, verse 10, you remember his wife didn't understand his spirit. And he says to her in verse 10 of chapter 2, he said, thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaketh. What? Shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? So this is exactly what Hannah's talking about, isn't it, when she says that Yahweh makes poor and Yahweh makes rich. He brings low and he lifts up. Just because we have trials doesn't mean that God has rejected us. Our problems in life are an indication that God is working with us. And so these expressions of Hannah in the 1st of Samuel chapter 2 and verse 7, I think remind us, out of her knowledge of Job's record, that Job was lifted out of sufferings and Yahweh brings such trials upon us for our good. In fact, it says verse 8, there's clearly an allusion to Job, isn't there? Verse 8, he raises up the poor out of the dust and lifteth up the beggar from the dunghill. Isn't that all about the spirit of Job, the man who actually dwelt upon the dunghill and dust and ashes? And do you know, incidentally, when Job was finally restored, or what the occasion was for the restoration of Job? Well, it says this. Now, I'll just read it to you. And as I read it to you, see if you think that this was the verse you were thinking of. When was Job restored, or in what context? And Yahweh turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends. When Job prayed for others. What do you think Hannah's been doing? Hannah's not praying about Hannah. Hannah's praying for the needs of the nation. And that was actually when Job's captivity was turned, when he prayed for others. And God's about to turn, God has turned, the captivity of Hannah in a very real sense, hasn't he? Because she likewise has shown concern for others in that remarkable way. In fact, you see what verse 8 goes on to say? It says, he lifts up the beggar from the dunghill to set them among princes and to make them inherit the throne of glory. And I think that when she talks about this one that was set among princes to inherit the throne of glory, I think she's got in mind little Samuel plucked from obscurity and sent to the temple, to the place of God's throne in Shiloh, where the spiritual decisions of the nation would be made. This little boy was sent into a place of significance, not because he was important and not because his mother was important, but because it was all in the providence of God that that might be so. And she believed in that. In fact, if you hold your hands and come to Psalm 113, here's another passage that clearly is drawing on Hannah's song in the context of the words that we see in this psalm. Psalm 113 has this to say, and there's a clear link to the thinking of Hannah on this occasion. So verse 5 of Psalm 113. Who is like unto Yahweh our God, who dwelleth on high, who humbleth himself to behold the things that are in heaven and in the earth. He raiseth up the poor out of the dust. And the margin says, see the first of Samuel chapter 2 verse 8, Hannah's song. He lifteth up the needy out of the dunghill, that he may set him with princes, even with the princes of his people. That's the first of Samuel chapter 2 verse 8. And just in case we're not sure that the psalm is thinking about Hannah and Hannah's song, it will finish with these words, verse 9. He maketh the barren woman to keep house and to be a joyful mother of children. See the first of Samuel chapter 2 verse 5, says the margin. Psalm 113 is another scripture that's quoting from and based upon Hannah's song and Hannah's prayer about the barren woman who was lifted out of the dust of despair. Oh yes, Hannah knew all about this. She knew about the wonder of that feeling. But she also knew how fragile life can be, even in the purposes of God. Because do you see what she now says in the first of Samuel 2 and verse 8? She says, he raises up the poor out of the dust. He lifts up the beggar from the dunghill to set them among princes and to make them inherit the throne of glory. And she says, because the pillars of the earth are Yahweh's, and he has set the world upon them. Now that word pillars is quite an unusual word. It's only found in one other place, in the 1 Samuel chapter 14 and verse 4. But it's associated with a word found in the 1 Kings chapter 7 and verses 15 and 16 about the molten pillars that were supports for the temple. So there were two pillars that were cast in molten metal, that they would be supports for the building. And I think the idea behind what Hannah is saying here is that everything is carefully balanced in the purpose of God, and he's the one in charge of those pillars. The pillars of the earth belong to God, and everything's carefully balanced in the circumstances of God, according to his providential wisdom. If you come to Psalm 75, I think there's an allusion to this. Again, a quotation of the psalm, thinking back and drawing upon Hannah's prayer again. Because Psalm 75 will say this about the significance of this idea. Psalm 75 says, verse 2, when I shall receive the congregation, I will judge uprightly. The earth and all the inhabitants thereof are dissolved. I bear up the pillars of it. I'm in charge of the pillars, says God. The pillars of the earth are Yahweh's, says Hannah. And the lesson of both the psalm and of Hannah's prayer is that the circumstances of life can be upset in a moment if God purposes that it be so, because it's all balanced very carefully by his objectives. And by the way, notice while we're in Psalm 75, verse 5, lift not up your horn on high, speak not with a stiff neck. And the margin says, see the first of Samuel chapter 2 verse 3. And verse 7 says, God is the judge, he putteth down one and setteth up the other. And the margin says, see the first of Samuel chapter 2 verse 7. And the psalm says, verse 10, all the horns of the right of the wicked will I cut off, but the horns of the righteous shall be exalted. And the margin says, see the first of Samuel chapter 2 verse 1. This psalm is also based upon Hannah's prayer, and what it teaches is the delicate balances of all the circumstances of life rest in the hands of the Father. It's just as well that we learn that in the journey of life, is it not? Just as well that we come to an understanding at some stage in our lives that life is much more fragile than we thought, much less certain than we thought. And in a moment, the pillars can be shaken. But it is all in the Father's control. And Hannah knew that despite the occasional shaking of the pillars of life, that what God promised, verse 9, in her song was that he will always keep the feet of his saints. So even though the balance of life can be upset quickly, easily, dramatically, the faithful ought never to fear, says Hannah, because he will always keep the feet of his saints. Rodham says, the feet of his loving ones doth he guard. The feet of his loving ones doth he guard. And the word is used in parallel to the idea of priests in the 2nd of Chronicles chapter 6, verse 41. So there's another promise here for Hannah herself and her little boy left alone in Shiloh, a promise that Yahweh recognized the priestly spirit in her son and in his mother and their love for things divine. And because of that, he would watch over them for good, because he was a saint. Little Samuel was a saint in that sense, a priestly saint, and so was his mother. And so maybe one of the lessons that Hannah's bringing forth in her prayer is that when all of our life seems hopeless and all of our strength seems powerless, that we have the assurance of an invisible, invincible spirit of guardian care that might bring comfort to our hearts. How often did Hannah pray, do you think, back in Ramah? How often do you think she prayed that Yahweh would keep the feet of her little boy in Shiloh? That he might keep the feet of his saint Samuel. And yet, for all of that, says the psalm, or says the song, the wicked shall be silent in darkness, for by strength shall no man prevail. And again, I suggest that these wicked ones were not the Philistines. She didn't have the Philistines in mind here when she talked about the wicked ones. I think this is the second reference to the spirit of Hophni and Phinehas. First, to their arrogant speech in verse 3. But now what she's saying is that their influence was going to be removed by the termination of death itself, a death that Hannah saw coming with prophetic insight when she says here that the wicked shall be silent in darkness, for by strength shall no man prevail. And that silent and darkness that she prophesies of is the silence of death itself. Now, if you come over the page again to the prophecy of the man of God, that's exactly what is promised, exactly what's prophesied. Because verse 32 says that when the man of God comes later on to pronounce judgment against Eli, he says in verse 32, thou shalt see an enemy in my habitation. In all the wealth which God shall give Israel, there shall not be an old man in thy house forever. And the man of thine, whom I shall not cut off from mine altar, shall be to consume thine eyes and to grieve thine heart. And all the increase of thy house shall die in the flower of their age. And this shall be a sign unto thee that shall come upon thy two sons, on Hophni and Phinehas. In one day they shall die, both of them. And so the wicked would be silent in darkness because death was going to come upon them both. Hannah's words were no more than what the judgment of God himself would pronounce upon these two boys later on in this very chapter. And why would they be overthrown in such a calamitous way? Because as the end of verse 9 of Hannah's song says, for by strength shall no man prevail. And if Phinehas was the representative of those who were arrogant in their words, then Hophni was the symbol of those who were aggressive in their deeds. The man of the clenched fist, as his name means. Even a mighty man, an ish, as the word is here, even a mighty man cannot prevail against the divine purpose. Even one who's given to aggressive deeds, says Hannah, will not succeed merely through the force of his power when it comes to opposing God. No matter what trials come upon us, the will of the Father will prevail. And Hannah believed that no one could stand against that, not even Hophni. And I think that we know that she's got those priests in mind because of what follows in the verse to come, in verse 10. In fact, what she says in verse 10, in the Hebrew text, the name of Yahweh is at the beginning of the sentence. So Green's literal translation translates verse 10 by saying, Yahweh, pause, will be smashed his strivers against him. And Rotherham says, as for Yahweh, they will be shattered who contend with him. And I think Hannah saw how important it was to be working with God rather than against him. Those who are found contending with God will be overthrown. We ought never to make that mistake in our lives, that whatever we do in our lives, it ought never to be that we're found opposing God. Because you can't win. You can't ever triumph if we're found in a situation where we find ourselves opposing God. And do you notice, you see how interesting, you see in verse 10 how interesting it is, that now the songs come full circle, a song that from start to finish was never about Hannah's objectives, but all about the Father's objectives. Because you see what how the song began? She says in verse 1, "My mouth is enlarged over mine enemies." Who are they? Verse 10. "The adversaries of Yahweh shall be broken to pieces." And so the point of this is that Hannah's enemies in verse 1 were none other than God's enemies in verse 10. And those adversaries, first and foremost, from Hannah's perspective, were the man of the brazen mouth, verses 3 and 4, and the man of the clenched fist, of verses 9 and 10. "Out of heaven," she says, "out of heaven shall he thunder upon them. Yahweh shall judge the ends of the earth." And so we've got a prophecy here, in Hannah's own words, of the ultimate overthrow, the impending overthrow of Hophni and Phinehas. And not just of an overthrow, but if of an overthrow, then of the setting up of another order beyond that. And so that new order that was to come, she also envisages. What would lie beyond Hophni and Phinehas? Well, she says, not only will Yahweh judge the ends of the earth, but he shall give strength unto his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. Which is a very good lesson in life, incidentally, because it's one thing to overthrow and to destroy, but it's another thing to establish something better as its replacement. And sometimes in ecclesial life, we have people that are discontented with the current order of things. And there might be significant grounds for being discontented. But when you say to people, "So what do you think would be a better solution or a better way?" "Oh, well, I don't know." Well, there's no point in us being grieved with the current order unless we perceive something better that will be better from the truth's perspective. You see, Hannah always knew what she was looking towards and looking for. She wasn't just seeking the overthrow of Hophni and Phinehas. She wanted a priest that could bring the nation back into fellowship with God. And that's how she's going to finish her song. And so she says, not just that those men be overthrown, but that a better thing be brought into its place. And so she says here, "Yahweh shall judge the ends of the earth, but then he shall give strength unto his king and to exalt the horn of his anointed." And as Hannah's mind soared beyond her own day, her words give utterance to the promise of Messiah which is to come. In fact, I think Psalm 2 and the promise of "he who will be enthroned upon Zion's hill as the Holy One of God" is drawn in measure also from the spirit of Hannah's prayer on this occasion. "He will exalt the horn of his anointed" is how she will close her song. And so I think that Hannah saw all of this in the birth of her son. She saw in Samuel a prototype and a model for the work of Messiah himself. Now, there's a very lovely thought when you think about it. What an ideal for every mother to strive for, to have such a desire for the development of their children, that their child will grow up to reveal the very spirit of Christ. If every mother was passionate that their child will grow up to be like the Messiah, then that would be a guiding line, wouldn't it, for the raising of a godly seed? And Hannah was filled with joy at the triumph of Yahweh's honor and the triumph of Yahweh's purpose. And she saw that purpose now as being focused on her son as the instrument for its achievement. You know, when that last line of her song left her lips, "he shall exalt the horn of his anointed," I think at that point we could say that her own vow of Nazarite dedication was accomplished. She's given the child, she's offered her song, her Nazarite vow is done. Now, you notice how the song begins and ends then. And notice this again, verse 1. My horn is exalted in Yahweh, becomes Yahweh will exalt the horn of his anointed. Verse 10. So Hannah's status and Hannah's power and Hannah's significance was subsumed into the exaltation of God's anointed one. She would be made whole and she would be made strong in him. And I think that suggests that Hannah's use of the term anointed here carries a priestly connotation as well as a kingly one. It's been rightly observed, incidentally, that Hannah's the first person to use the word Mashiach concerning a king to come. He shall exalt the horn of his Mashiach, the Messiah, the anointed one. But do you know that that word, Mashiach, she's not the first person to use the word? Because the word's been found in the book of the law four times. Do you think Hannah had a copy of the book of the law? Yes. I think she got that term from the book of the law. Now let me show you that word in the book of the law. It's only found four times. Mashiach. Leviticus chapter 4. I think Hannah had such an amazing grasp and biblical knowledge comes cascading out of her prayer. Even the language she uses is thoroughly scriptural and it evokes scriptural thoughts. Now, here's the word Mashiach. Hannah's going to be the first one to apply it to a person in that sense. But it's in Leviticus 4, verse 3, when it says, if the priest that is anointed, but that's the word Mashiach. It's not a king. He's an anointed priest. He's a Mashiach priest. And again, verse 5, the priest that is anointed, Mashiach. And again in verse 16 of that verse, and that chapter, the priest that is anointed, Mashiach, shall bring of the bullock's blood. And in chapter 6 and verse 22, likewise, it will say, and the priest of his sons that is anointed in his stead, Mashiach, shall offer it. So these are the only references to the word Mashiach before Hannah's song. So every time the word anointed is used, and the only places she could have got the word from are about an anointed priest. And I think that's what Hannah has in mind here, is not just a king, but a priest. Her prayer, her desire, reaches a climax in the expectation of one to come who'll be both king and priest after a completely different order to the order that Hophni and Phinehas belong to through the line of Aaron. And I think from the outset, you see, she envisaged another priestly line that will supersede the existing order in Shiloh. And in her song of prophecy, she saw that old order of Aaron being swept away together with Hophni and Phinehas, and a new priestly order being brought in the Mashiach that she had in mind. Look, you see, whatever trials Penina had caused and whatever threat the Philistines had brought, these were not the adversaries of Yahweh that Hannah was focused upon. Her contention was against the corrupt and evil priesthood of Hophni and Phinehas and their destruction of the nation's fellowship with God. And her greatest joy lay in the fact that with the giving of Samuel to Yahweh, this, said Hannah, is not the end of the matter, this is just the beginning. I have given the child, but this is not where the story ends, this is where the story starts. Now is the controversy of Yahweh's purpose. Now let the time of recompense for his temple commence. Now let the battle be joined, she says. And that was exactly what she had yearned for, exactly what she had prayed about. And so she brought the child, she left him with God in Shiloh, and she professed herself to be happy with all that had happened on this day. Happy. So is that really how she felt? How can we be sure that the spirit of this song, as we've suggested, turned in the main on the wickedness of Hophni and Phinehas, that that's where her focus was? How can we be certain that she looked for the defeat and the triumph of God's purpose in the overthrow of that household in particular? How can we be sure that she really believed in this little holy Nazarite child, that in him lay the seeds of another priesthood and the promise of a better priest to come? How would we know that that's really what she was thinking of in this song? Well, that's the subject of our next study. So let's close our session this morning by singing together hymn 319, a hymn that contemplates that moment in time when there shall indeed be kings and priests of a new order restored to the land, as it says in the third verse, with gentle beams on Zion shine, raise up her kings, restore her priests, and by thine energy divine, let sacred love o'erflow their feasts. Hymn 319. So I don't know whether there's snacks downstairs, but I have it on good authority that there is.